listening to Tech Talk Radio, proudly sponsored by D-Link, building networks for people.
I don't think anyone should think this is a license to continue to breach copyright. iiNet is not responsible for stopping it.
There's no real demand for censorship of the internet in Australia. There's no other country in the Western world, at least, that's trying anything like this.
Netflix aren't better at anything, but we think we've got something, and we call it the iPad.
And today, we're delighted to be present at the creation of digital radio in Australia.
Senator Conroy is completely botching the implementation of this filtering policy of his.
For adults who want to be able to watch the other material, we're not proposing to do that.
On air, on the internet, and on the pod, you're listening to Tech Talk Radio.
Hello everybody, I'm Andrew McCollum and welcome to this week's edition of Tech Talk Radio, proudly brought to you by D-Link. This week, a new internet survey by Whirlpool, Australia's leading internet forum, highlights the underlying thoughts of Australian internet users when it comes to Conroy's controversial internet filter, which, if surveys are to be believed, could be the undoing of the Rudd government at the next federal election later this year. According to Whirlpool's website, the survey was conducted over a four-week period from the 1st of January to the 1st of February this year, during which it was successfully completed and verified a total of 23,683 times. The results show a significant opposition to the government's ISP filtering plan, with only 7.4% indicating their support. It also reveals that over 90% of respondents believe they could easily circumvent the filter if it was in place. The survey also covers consumers' attitudes on a wide variety of topics relating to their choice of broadband ISP and hardware, which we'll discuss in length later on today's show. The survey also revealed that education is paramount to online safety. Educating parents about the perils of the online world should be the government's main priority, even above educating children. Parents are responsible for what their children say and do online, and greater emphasis needs to be placed on getting parents to learn and share with their kids online, regardless of whether they are or are not internet savvy. Surfing the web should be a family affair, not just left to the unsupervised computer in the study. We'll also hear from Dr. Ron on today's show, who also took to the streets this week and made his way to the State Library of Victoria, which is located at the northern end of the Melbourne CBD, for the Open Internet Rally.
This week on Tech Talk Radio.
With the launch of Apple's new iPad, Adam talks to Ruslan Kogan about his new tablet. Hungry Beast has some very thought-provoking words to say about Google. Gen Y, well, not too sure about their IT future. Apple sues HTC over phones with Google software, and is internet censorship a vote changer? First up, though, here's Dr. Ron with the latest from the Tech Talk News Desk.
This is Tech Talk News.
This week on Tech Talk News, Australian computers are ensnared in a Spanish botnet. America's Federal Aviation Administration investigates a younger-than-usual air traffic controller. Apple takes legal action against HTC for alleged patent infringements. NBN Co. announces 5 mainland test sites for our new high-speed network. And a Korean baby starves in real life because her parents are too obsessed with their virtual life. Welcome to Tech Talk News. Spanish police last week arrested 3 people as part of an investigation into what they described as one of the largest computer botnets ever detected. A botnet is a network of illegally infected computers which can be used to launch denial-of-service attacks, distribute spam emails, spyware or viruses, or even harvest credit card or banking details. The network, known as the Mariposa botnet, was used to steal bank details from more than 13 million computers in 190 countries, including PCs from at least 100 companies so far identified in Australia. Head of the Spanish Civil Guard's cybercrime unit, Commander Juan Salon, said that fortunately the botnet was controlled by someone who hadn't yet realised how powerful it actually was. This translation from the ABC's AM program.
El primer detenido tenía The first person who was arrested had around 800,000 electronic bank details and personal email data in his computer. That indicates that in the servers, which is where all the information is sent, there must be millions of data. All of that still needs to be analysed. As you can appreciate, the volume of the information is huge. We have been lucky that this botnet of 13 million computers was in the hands of people who didn't realise its full potential. We have been lucky.
The criminals reportedly used a virus to infect machines by exploiting a vulnerability in Microsoft's Internet Explorer web browser. This then allowed the criminals to record keystrokes and login credentials. The Mariposa botnet was initially identified by a Canadian internet security company, Defence Intelligence, in May last year. A joint investigation with the FBI and Spanish police led to its shutdown in December and to last week's arrests. Spanish police say that more arrests are expected soon in other countries. The Federal Aviation Administration is investigating how a child was allowed to direct planes at New York's JFK International Airport. An audio tape of American air traffic was released last week, which contains what sounds like a young boy directing pilots on an aviation radio frequency for some minutes.
JetBlue 171, clear for takeoff.
Clear for takeoff, JetBlue 171.
You get guys when the kids are out of school.
JetBlue 171, contact departure.
Over to departure, JetBlue 171. Awesome job.
03, clear for takeoff.
403, clear to takeoff. Thank you very much. You have a great day.
AMAC 403, contact departure. Adios. Adios, amigos.
Adios, amigos. Over to departure, JetBlue 195.
While the pilots on tape do not appear concerned that a child is giving complex air traffic instructions, the FAA was unimpressed and said in a statement last week that the employee responsible was no longer controlling air traffic. The FAA spokesperson said that this behaviour is not acceptable and does not demonstrate the kind of professionalism expected from all FAA employees. The National Air Traffic Controllers Association said the incident was not indicative of the highest professional standards that controllers set for themselves and exceed each and every day in the advancement of aviation safety. Apple has launched legal action against mobile phone manufacturer HTC for alleged patent violations. Apple CEO Steve Jobs said last week, "We can sit by and watch competitors steal our patented inventions, or we can do something about it." At least some of the patents in dispute relate to the iPhone's user interface. In addition to monetary damages, Apple is seeking a permanent exclusion order, which would prohibit HTC from importing infringing devices and components. These devices include Android-powered phones available in Australia, including the HTC Dream and the HTC Magic. The corporation in charge of deployment of Australia's high-speed national broadband network last week announced five sites selected as testbeds for the $43 billion rollout. NBN company chief executive Mr. Mike Quigley and communications minister Senator Stephen Conroy jointly announced the five first-released sites. They are Brunswick in Melbourne's inner north, an area of Townsville covering parts of Aitken Vale and Munding Borough, New South Wales coastal communities of Minamurra and Kiama Downs south of Wollongong, an area west of Armidale in New South Wales, which includes the University of New England, and the rural town of Woolunga in South Australia. Each site has about 3,000 premises and will be used to test network design and construction methods. Actual construction of the NBN is expected to start early in the second half of this year. And in a shocking report to emerge from South Korea, a couple there let their baby starve to death after becoming obsessed with raising a virtual daughter online. The Age Tech last week reported that the mother and father discovered their severely dehydrated and malnourished 3-month-old daughter, which they left at home while they spent 12-hour stints at internet cafes. Police said the parents were addicted to a role-playing game called Prius and were raising a virtual daughter on the internet while their own daughter was left unattended at home. A spokesperson for the National Scientific Criminal and Investigation Laboratory said that the girl appeared to have starved to death. The mother and father have been charged with child abuse and neglect. I'm Dr. Ron, and that's your tech update for this week.
Previously on Tech Talk Radio.
Last Thursday, the three networks switched from Telstra's, the old GSM network, yep, to Vodafone's network.
It costs $4 per SMS.
Whoa.
Might not be good for the lolly sales.
It's a real problem. It's a real problem.
I almost pass out with laughter. Lol.
Sounded a bit dodgy to me. That was hissy or not quite right.
You want us to take talkback?
Well, I've got it on my Nokia phone, which is running Nokia-ish. That was an interesting sound.
It was.
It's in the cradle and it's all plugged in. That's
fine. Because I can stick things in its bottom.
Yeah, but the, there's a story here, ladies and gentlemen.
No, we won't go there.
In America, there's TV channels are talking about broadcasting. I think it's the American football, the sort of gridiron cross-country wrestling they do over there, whatever it's called.
Entertaining, informative, and independent. You're listening to Tech Talk Radio.
Did you just say gridiron cross-country wrestling or something?
Yeah, well, I don't know what that would... Yeah.
The panel on Tech Talk Radio.
Ah, yes, welcome everybody. We are the panel, Tech Talk Radio and all that sort of stuff. Welcome again. I'm just setting up this evening. It's been one of those days today. Joining the panel this evening, Dr. Graham, who's just swinging his microphone around. Go and have a squeak there, Graham.
Okay, you...
Yeah.
Hold on. So I was trying to move it without making a noise.
Yeah, welcome aboard this evening. Dr. Ron, you've been in the city. You got a report for us tonight?
Yes, got a good report, Andrew. Had a good day on Saturday before the heavens opened in Melbourne.
Yes, it did, didn't it?
Oh, it got a fair bit of rain. I know that Queensland's had more than their fair share of rain over the last few weeks, but far out, Brussels sprout. In the space of half an hour, it went from light to dark and no rain to about, what was it, 16 mils in 15 minutes or something.
Correct. The difference between Queensland and Melbourne at the moment is their damage is rising and ours is falling.
Yes, exactly.
We, from the office, the Tech Talk offices in Hawthorne, we were looking out the window when the rainstorm came through at about 3 o'clock on Saturday afternoon. To our delight, there was a Mercedes across the road from us. Fairly expensive one. Or was it a BMW? Can't remember. But anyway, about 120 grand's worth of car. And in the hailstorm, he left the sunroof open, didn't he?
Oh, don't you hate that?
That leather interior will be damaged.
Who's that voice? Who's that voice?
It sounded like stranger. JD.
JD, welcome back. Where have you been? Did you bring a note?
Well, I've been to Alice Springs and I've been to Darwin and, a few places. And now you're talking about the rain. I've never seen Alice Springs green.
Hey, the Todd
green.
River had water through it, I saw.
Yeah, it was amazing.
It? Was there any water in the Todd River whilst you were there?
I didn't go out to see it. We flew over quite a few of the rivers that looked as though they were brimming when normally they wouldn't be.
Yeah?
But yeah, landing at Alice Springs Airport, for example, everything was green alongside the tarmac.
That's pretty impressive. Mm. It's like where the McDonnell Ranges go through, where the railway line and the road and the river go through just as you come into Alice Springs there.
Yep.
Never seen that full of water before, but no. I did the other day. Not that I was there, but just saw it on the news.
It's just amazing out there.
Isn't it? Anyway, so what's been news? What's happening?
Business or pleasure, JD, in Alice Springs?
Business, actually.
Yes.
Yeah, talking about some IT systems we want to develop, so it's all good.
Oh, very good. Yeah. So, what's news? You haven't been here for ages. Have Apple launched a new OS?
They haven't done anything terribly interesting for a little while. The iPad's still coming. The latest news is the end of April for Australia.
Well, the beginning... Actually, Adam sent me an email just the other day about that, because I'm going to the United States. I think he's hankering for me to bring one back But I think, am I there?
March. I might be wrong.
I think I might have left by the time it comes out. I think it's the 22nd April or something.
And so whilst we get Wi-Fi and 3G when it's released in Australia, which is good, there's no news about getting any books or anything on the iTunes site. And one of the interesting things is New Zealand's not even listed as a site at all, so we're not quite sure what's happening over there.
Sorry? New Zealand's not listed as a site?
Yeah, there's no discussion about New Zealand for launch or certainly for iTunes.
Really?
So, they might be waiting a long
time. Are
they
still Clayton's Australians?
I think they must be treated that way, which is a bit sad. Sorry to all the New Zealand listeners.
Yes. Yes, exactly. Oh, well, I guess the more the merrier on the Australian iTunes store, really, isn't it?
Yeah, well, we'll have to wait and see if they actually do release some books and how long it's going to take them, because we know that movies and songs and all those sorts of things took forever to come out in Australia, and it looks like it hasn't changed.
Now, with the iPad, it's going to take a different type of SIM card than the one that we are used to here.
Micro SIM. Similar. Yeah,
it's a lot smaller.
So you can get out the razor blades and cut down your existing ones.
Oh, dear.
Or go and order a new one from the company, which means that they'll know exactly what you want it for.
Ah.
Telltale sign, huh?
I don't know, are there any telephones here on the market that use micro SIMs, are there at the moment?
I'm not aware of any.
No.
All right, due to the wonders of modern technology, we're going to open up Fader 1 and see if Warlock's in Sydney this evening. Come in, Warlock.
I'm right here. How's it going, guys?
Good, you're running on delay up there. Stop listening on the stream.
That's a brain delay.
Yeah, turn your radio off in the background. Isn't that what they say on the commercial radio
stations? That's what they say, yes.
Yeah, we'll hang up on you and come back to you. So how's Tricks in Sydney? You probably haven't had it like we have down here.
No, nothing like that. It's currently quite warm up here at the moment. Had hardly a bit of a sprinkle or something like that, but nothing as serious as you guys getting wiped out. Jeez.
Yeah.
I saw in the news, they were saying it's like a mini cyclone or something.
Oh, we had it all down here. I feel for most of, most of the countryside between north of Melbourne really copped plenty in the last little bit. But anyway,
isn't four seasons in one day the standard down there, though?
Absolutely. Absolutely, and we had five.
We're getting the climate extreme seasons.
We even had night at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. It was very scary, as Dr. Ron was saying. He was driving around the burbs. But yeah, a lot of damage. But anyway, we're not a weather show. We're a technological show, apparently. How's the technology in Sydney going? Is it still working up there all right at the moment, Warlock?
Yeah, it seems to be going quite well, guys.
We are on delay, aren't we? There's a severe delay on Skype this evening. Anyway, maybe it's just the way we're holding your mouse. But anyway, welcome aboard, Warlock. Now, Dr. Ron, let's kick the show off with something that's very near and dear to us at the moment. The Hutchison 3 network changed their role fallback when you can't get hold of a 3 site
on your mobile phone. We only spoke about this last week or the week
before. Thursday week, they changed.
Mm. Have we noticed a difference in the network performance or what?
Can I say, 3, if you don't lift your game very shortly with your cellular coverage, and it's not what I would call a mobile coverage anymore, there's going to be people churning away from you in their droves, because I think we did it twice on separate days, having a chat between myself, mobile, and Dr. Ron in the hallowed halls of the Dr. Ron residence, and I'm not kidding. We must have dropped out half a dozen times.
Yeah, at least probably 6 or 7 retries.
Where we would never normally lose a call. All the way when it was traditionally roaming to Telstra and all that, the network worked fine. But now, since Hutchison have decided to roll over to Vodafone, well, yes, heaven help you Vodafone people.
We've started hearing the sort of digital noise that you hear on GSM networks that we haven't heard on 3G networks here for years and years and years. It's absolutely, it's a completely bizarre. You hear this interference and this the poor call quality noise, and you think, why am I hearing that? It's something that I've completely forgotten all about, something which should belong in the dim, dark past. But it's just suddenly in the last couple of weeks, it's reappeared on our voice calls. And as Andrew was saying, like today was a classic example. He's driving home from Tech Talk Radio Skunkworks there back to his home, and it should be just half hour drive, 20-minute drive, and you're trying to ring me on the phone, and we probably tried 6 or 7 times to get a phone call through, and it was ridiculous.
I drove in the inner suburbs of Melbourne for over a kilometre and a half without any 3G coverage.
Without any coverage at all. Even if there's no 3G coverage, you should be going onto the Vodafone GSM system now. It was just non-existent.
So I think I'm going back to Telstra. By goodness me, they have the best network. So,
how do people who are Vodafone customers cope with this normally? Are they faced with this sort of problem ordinarily? I don't know if this is usual for them or not. Well, I've never been a Vodafone customer exclusively, so I've had no experience with their GSM network.
My wife used to be with Vodafone and actually quite liked it. She was a city dweller, still is, and got good service. She just churned because of cost and the iPhone. She wanted to go to an iPhone, and at the point, you had to go to Optus or Telstra, so she went Optus. So she didn't think the quality was too bad, but that's when it was Vodafone only.
Sorry, and Skype is dropping out tonight.
As you can hear.
As you can hear in the background there. So, yes.
Is it Vodafone proudly brought to you by Skype or the other way around?
No, I think it's the other way around.
Oh, okay. Anyway.
Warlock, stop pushing buttons up there. You dropped out. Oh, he's gone again.
No problem.
Oh, no, he's back again.
So, the answer is 3. Yeah, lift your game. Come on, you have to do something about this, about us roaming onto Vodafone, because maybe it's a problem that Vodafone weren't expecting in terms of the new traffic that their network suddenly has to accommodate. I don't know. But
is it just a teething issue? Is it just settling down? The handover's not working correctly. Where's Mark when you need him?
Maybe. Yeah, maybe it's something like that. Don't know. Well, time will tell.
Tell us if you've got any issues out there in Tech Talk Radio land. Chat.techtalkradio.com.au. There's lots of people typing O in the chat at the moment. So, but come along and type something constructive if you like. Tell us about your experiences.
Or type O.
With or typo, yes. And there's quite a few people in the chat this evening. I'm just having a bit of a scroll there. Hello, everybody. Darren in the UK. Brad's there. If you're Dr. Laney's there. That's good.
If you're not listening live, though, and if you'd like to comment on anything that we talk about during the program, you can go to forum.techtalkradio.com.au. That's up 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And it provides exactly that, a forum for people to talk about topics that we discuss.
Mm.
You can also view us on Ustream tonight, JD. We're running
we've got
Ustream.
Cameras and videos.
Yeah,
and
cameras everywhere
like
today.
There you go, ustream.tv/techtalkradioau, and click on the Go to Show page link.
You know what's good about the forum?
What's good about the forum, Graham?
What's good about the
Welcome
forum?
Welcome to Tech Talk tonight, by the way. Yes.
I did speak
good,
a little
good
bit
to hear
earlier.
From you.
I've been sitting here quietly. What's good about the forum is it's kind of the opposite of the chat. The chat's good for people who can listen at 8 o'clock on a Monday night when we're all here. But for people who listen on the podcast, listen on the train, you know, listening on stations that take us at other times of the week, the forum you can log on to at any time, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and still participate in the discussion. You read what people have written, and you can write an answer, put something back, and you can come back the next day and see what people have commented on. You don't have to be real time, and the forum's great for those sorts of people who aren't here when we do the show at 8 o'clock Melbourne time.
And
on
you can
Monday
make
night.
Suggestions for content for the show.
And in fact, that's a great place to put suggestions for content to the show, because you can link us up to other things, and we can refer back to it later on when we're doing planning for the show. So yeah,
this would be a good time to say hello to the new forum members: DragonFan79 and Warlock. About time you registered as a member. That's good. Freak and Levi Luke. Levi's sent us email feedback as well.
We got any correspondence?
So,
maybe enter it into now.
We do have correspondence, and we do have correspondence. This was a post from the forum from DragonFan79. He says, "Hi, I have a quandary. I've been pondering for some time. I've searched lots of sites, but I'm still undecided. I'm hoping for advice. I want to copy all my CDs to digital storage. Currently, I use iTunes for this, as I like the ease and linkage to my iPods."
iTunes makes it nice and easy and doesn't do a bad job, and you can configure it to control the quality if you want to.
However, these are currently in AAC format.
Ah.
"I would like to rip all my CDs in better quality. I understand this would be AAIF or WAVE, but I know these take up a lot of space. Apple Lossless seems a good option, but I want to be able to stream my music to my HD TV and receiver. And I know that Apple TV does this, but for example, WDTV Live doesn't. The other thing I have is lots of photos of my kids and family and home videos. I would like to view them on the HD plasma. So my questions are, I need a format for ripping and storing music, which has high sound quality but is not too memory intensive. And can be streamed by my TV receiver and also be able to send photos and home videos. Is there an answer? Apple TV does Apple Lossless and photos, but not sure about videos. WDTV Live does the videos and I think photos and stuff, but not iTunes Lossless. Also, just to be difficult, if I went lossless, can I upload those to my iPods? And can you convert them to less memory-hungry formats for that?"
Okay, I missed everything after the first question. What was the first one?
The first one says, "I have a quandary, can I get some advice?"
Okay, good.
The answer is yes.
I'd post that up on the forum, as Graham said
it
before.
It's already on the forum.
Okay,
so
that's excellent. Look, yes, lossless is one of those things that I think, well, Graham, you're a bit of a advocate for quality audio.
Yeah, and I'm going to say something that might surprise you. Apple's AAC format, even though it's not lossless, is a very high quality format if you give it sufficient bandwidth. So as long as you're not ripping to really low,
well, that's the solution, then, isn't
it? Rates.
Get yourself a WDTV Live and use AAC, because I think is it? No, maybe not. I was just thinking the WTV Live had a Apple client in it, but doesn't. I'm thinking of an NAS. As you were.
I don't
want to confuse people. Forget what I just said. But yes,
look, for the whole gamut of what you want, you're probably best sticking with using the Apple lossy compression, but just give it a little bit more than standard bitrate if you're a little bit unhappy with the quality. That's all controllable. You can control the rip format within iTunes and set it to that. You're not going to be able to use any of the more exotic formats there. WAV is obviously going to be quite wasteful and isn't going to be very suitable for some of the things you're using there. Someone on the chat suggested FLAC, which is a beautiful codec.
Very uncompressed and lossless, isn't it?
It's losslessly compressed.
Yes.
So you don't get like the 10-to-1 compression rates that you get from MP3s and AACs. But you get some compression out of it, and it's completely lossless. You expand it back out, you get exactly what you had before, full uncompressed quality. But not all these devices he wants to use will support FLAC. So
one of the things too these days is hard drives aren't that dear anymore, if you hadn't noticed. What's the deal? Why don't you just go and buy a fairly sizable hard drive? 1.5 terabyte seems to come to mind. And forget about the file size. Just go for gold.
And just rip to WAV, which is uncompressed. Problems with that he's going to experience is he wants to be able to listen to stuff on it and easily move it to his iPod and portable players.
And
so it's going
to
chew up,
which is
going to
be compressed anyway.
Not necessarily. It's going to use the format that it's ripped to within iTunes. Okay, so you know, that could be a problem. And also, he wants to stream it to his devices, so if he's using full WAV format, even though they might play it, it's going to chew up his network bandwidth again.
Mm-hmm. So the AAC seems to be the option. Is that the way you sort of...
Look, on the first reading of it, I haven't gone through all the technicalities of it, but that would be my first try. So, and as, someone's saying in the chat now, that's someone who's identified as a Queensland listener, I think. AAC 128K is equivalent in quality to MP3 256K, so AAC quality is supposedly better. I know that those figures are very subjective, and I'm not sure that I quite believe them. But even so, AAC quality tends to be very good for the bitrate as compared with MP3s. If you rip to, say, 256K AAC, then you're probably, you know, going to have to really struggle, really listen hard on really good quality equipment to pick up what loss there is, if you can. And you're probably not going
to
pick it.
Well, that's the thing, isn't it? You've got to have good speakers, good audio system to actually hear it. I must admit, at work, though, I didn't think I could pick the difference between 44.1 and 48K, but having listened to two things side by side, it's quite obvious. It's quite obvious. But anyway, there you go. Obviously, people are noticing that in the home audio world.
You are like me, though. You tend to listen very critically, and you tend to listen in very good quality headphones.
Yes, and good studio monitors,
and
too.
And good studio monitors goes a long, long, long way.
But if you've got some little earbud headphones, you're going out for a jog, and you've just got your music player strapped to your arm, it might not be as critical.
That's exactly right. And if you've got your music player strapped to your arm, it's probably a Nano, it's probably not a full-size iPod, and you're going to want to get as many songs on there as possible, and that's going to be more critical than getting full studio quality. So,
Dragon fan, we hope this has helped. If you want to comment on that post, you can go to forum.techtalkradio.com.au, have a look at the how-tos and free advice section, and it's there.
And I would encourage anyone who's got an interest in audio and file formats and all that sort of stuff to go there and post in that thread, because I think that's going to be an interesting discussion.
There you go. The only other piece of feedback we had during the week, Andrew, was from a lady who says, "Hello, my name is Elena. I write you. I go to your country very soon. I want to meet you and spend days with you."
Dr. Ron.
It did. It came in from...
Yes, no.
I've got it written here. It says, "Please write me soon."
I'll explain about those emails a bit later on for you.
Oh.
We do have an article, if we get to it, on the rundown,
too. You haven't sent any money, have you?
About the massive increase of spam of recent time, too.
I sent her $10,000 because she said that she couldn't raise enough money for her airfare, but...
Oh.
Do we need to talk about this after?
Yeah, we might.
We might have a chat off the air later. There'll be a few others. Yes.
That's all.
Well done there, Dr.
That's
Ron.
That's all our feedback, Andrew.
All right, you're listening to Tech Talk Radio. Dr. Ron, Graham Callaghan, and myself, Andrew McConnell, and JD, special guest this evening. Says he with a smirk on his face.
Special guest, JD.
Special guest, JD.
It's been a while.
He'll be off and again for another 3 weeks, squandering around the countryside. There's been lots happening, and when I put the rundown together this week, not that we generally tend to stick to it that much, but I actually had to drop things which I wanted to talk about because there's just going to be so much to talk. Lydia sent some stuff over from the United States, which we're going to hold over for next week. Adam's talking to Ruslan Kogan this week in his... Sorry, I just saw something very funny happen in the studio and you boys missed it.
No, I completely missed that too. I'm sorry, I'll have to look back on the Ustream a bit
Absolutely.
Later.
Absolutely. Yes. Ruslan Kogan is talking to Adam Turner about the new iPad sort of threat, if that's a word. Mm-hmm. Ruslan's making a one of those little notepad-y sort of, things that iPad equivalent sort of, I can't use the right word, but you know what I mean. He's going to come up with a little
tablet.
That's
device.
The word. So there's an interesting interview coming up there. Also, we have the internet survey, which came out this week, which we're going to talk about next, from Broadband Choice, which I think is quite interesting. But then again, we'll talk about that and see what people think. What else is happening? And, oh, yes, the other interesting thing, which really got my ear during the course of the week. Do any of you watch Hungry Beast at all?
Yes.
ABC TV?
I watched Hungry Beast during the week on iView.
Yes.
Which means I watched it on the internet after it had gone to air.
Yes.
There's something in it for everybody.
There's
this way.
Something in that show in that for last absolutely program. Everybody. Now, there was a very interesting article on Google, which I'd like to play a piece of later in the show, and we'll have a bit of a chat about the panel there too. But
that's going back a couple of weeks, isn't it? The Google
March the 3rd? No, I think it was last week. But anyway, yes. But first, upward and onwards, let's talk a little bit about the internet survey that came out during the course of the week. And this was by Broadband Choice, which is probably Australia's peak portal, is that the right word for it? They're up the top of the ladder there when it comes to internet surveys, and people trust it quite a lot, I think. Now, they had a survey. It lasted for a month. They had 23,683 correspondents that actually filled out their survey form correctly, which is really good.
Wow.
And the survey was all about the internet. What, how, why, and the likes. And the lead question, which I think is fairly topical at the moment, was, in principle, do you support the idea of mandatory internet filtering? Now, you've got to bear in mind that this audience is probably fairly internet savvy.
It's a captive audience for them.
It is. But surprisingly, or maybe not surprisingly, 92.6% of respondents said that it's not a good idea. Now, what do you make of that, boys? Is this because I think most tech-savvy internet people know that it's just a bad thing? Or is this? Do you think this is coming from the heart of a lot of internet users in Australia, considering they had 23,000 respondents?
Now, it's a good.
Everyone knows it's probably not going to work. It's going to slow things down for us. It's going to block things that shouldn't and won't block things that should. And it's just going to be a bit of a mess and make us a laughing stock in the internet world, I think.
Well, I think you're right. In a lot of respects, Warlock, because I think last week we were talking about the fact, or it might have been a while back, that no other Western country does anything like this. We're going to be trendsetters. We're going to turn into like the Chinese firewall, I guess, which is only going to make that or provide a challenge to the younger people to get their way around it. And that was another question in the survey as well, that regardless of the policy, people will be able to, or can they already work a way around a firewall, to which majority of the people actually said, yes, I'm just trying to find the actual number here, but I'll have a look at that fairly shortly and get back to you. But
with VPNs and anonymous proxy servers and that rife throughout the world, there's not really any way. I mean, a lot of them will just go through the onion router, which might slow them down a little bit, but they'll always get what they want.
Exactly. I found the question. The question was, do you believe you have the technical know-how to circumvent the mandatory ISP filter? Well, over 90% of their survey audience believes that they have the means to bypass the proposed filter, combined with the fact that the filter will not block non-web technologies. It seems unlikely that anyone seriously interested in pursuing banned content would be hindered, which makes it sort of like where we've gone full circle, haven't we? Why bother?
Well, I think that's an interesting observation, because I don't think mums and dads would know how to do it, but their kids may well, and that's the problem.
But the mums and dads aren't the target audience for these nasty sites. It's the kids.
That's right, but if the mums and dads don't know how to circumvent, then they don't know what to look out for in their home family PC that the kids are using. So I think that's one of the dilemmas here, is that whilst the parents might feel comfortable that, well, I don't know how to get around it, therefore little Johnny won't know, they probably do.
And so I think that's one not only that, but it's important to point out, anyone who's capable of getting on Whirlpool, joining a forum, even getting on Google and doing a basic search, can get around this filter. You don't need to be tech-savvy or an internet guru or a programmer or anything like that. All you need to be is someone who can use Google. And look, anyone who's on the net can use Google. All you do is you Google the right words and the instructions pop up on how to do it, step by step, dead easy. Anyone can do it. It's not something that only tech-savvy people can do.
All right. Some other interesting questions. Will the introduction of a mandatory filter affect your vote at the next federal election? For those listening offshore, Australia has a federal election coming up in November this year. And Mr. Conroy, the man who is driving the filtering policy, is in the party, which potentially, I don't know, they may not. But anyway, any of you guys got an opinion about whether or not this is going to hit them in the polls, this filter?
If people will be voting because of the filter, then they could be having a false sense of security, thinking, well, Kevin Rudd's filter is going to look after my kids, so I don't have to monitor them on the internet anymore, which is very bad for the parents to choose, because obviously it's not going to, and if they're going to throw votes his way because of that, it's going to end up being a false win.
So is it safe to say that the Luddite factor is potentially going to kick in here, Warlock?
I would expect so.
It's interesting. One of the other questions, what should the government focus on in terms of internet safety? 83% said educating parents. That was the top responding, followed by educating children at 64%.
Mm. How about law enforcement? How about educating police? How about providing police who've got an interest in cyber safety?
Law enforcement came in at 43%. That was number three.
Like the cyber safety expert who used to work for Victoria Police but doesn't anymore.
Well, yeah, I guess.
He's been on this show.
Yes, I think there is a big need for that in the school environments in particular, but also for the fact that the parents need to come at it as well, because
It needs to be, everybody needs to be on board. But
parents,
yes,
are legally responsible for what their kids do and say online, like they are what they do and say out in the, you know, out in the community. So, you know, you can't just turn a blind eye. A parent would, I would hope, shun at the idea of driving a car whilst intoxicated or under the influence of something. So why would they not take an interest in what their kids are doing online for the same reason?
I agree totally.
Anyway, it's going to be interesting. Now, Dr. Ron, you caught up with, you went into the city, didn't you, and had a chat to, how would you say, how many people were there? Tell us a bit about it.
There were lots of people there. We went, myself and Graham.
You exaggerate. It was a disappointing turnout, really, wasn't it? We're talking about the Stop the Filter protest rally.
Which happened on the weekend.
Happened in various cities around Australia on the weekend. We went to the one that was in Melbourne. And
how many people would you say were there? About 200, 300 people?
I'd say 200 if you're lucky. Yeah.
It was good to see the people there, but Graham's right. There needs to be a lot more. And further to what Andrew's saying about, is it going to become a vote changer or not? The answer is that there's a lot more work to do in terms of educating people and raising awareness about this issue in the community for it to be a vote changer. If there's only going to be 200 or 300 people in Melbourne, for example, that turn out and show an interest in this, the government's not going to care less about what people think.
That's absolutely right. It's not a vote-changing issue, unfortunately. It probably should be, but it's not going to be.
And the other thing is that when you look at this survey that Broadband Choice has done, it's very interesting, but is it representative? Like, despite the fact there's, what were there, Andrew, 23,000 respondents or something, it's not representative of the Australian population. It's people who use Broadband Choice, who are aware that the survey is there and who are interested sufficiently to spend some time and complete a survey, but it doesn't show what the average mum and dad think about it. Myself and Graham, we went to the rally, or the picnic, if you like, or whatever it was
touted. Picnic at the library?
Yeah, family day in front of the State Library in Melbourne. And we had to listen to some of the speakers there, and this is a little bit about what happened. Well, there were no burning effigies of Stephen Conroy. There were no hooded anarchists hurling wheelie bins through shop windows. But the 300-odd people that attended Melbourne's Open Internet Rally on Saturday were informed, passionate, and a little bit angry. Speakers from different political parties and non-political speakers, and even pro-euthanasia lobbyists, all united to voice their concerns over Senator Conroy's proposed net filter legislation. If you're unaware of the proposal, the federal government is planning to amend the Broadcasting Services Act and introduce a mandatory network-based web filter. This filter will monitor and censor websites that appear on a government-run blacklist. This blacklist will prohibit you, the Australian web surfer, from viewing content which would attract a refused classification rating by the National Classification Board. The filter, according to Stephen Conroy, is part of a comprehensive suite of measures to address issues faced by families when they're online. Senator Conroy says that a trial of the net filter showed that ISP-level filtering of a defined list of URLs can be delivered with 100% accuracy, although there is considerable evidence against Senator Conroy's assertion, particularly in light of false positives where legitimate websites were incorrectly blocked. Those that oppose the net filter say that it will impact on the speed of everyone's web browsing, that the massive initial cost to the taxpayer will be compounded further by ongoing fees passed from ISPs to customers, that any list of refused classification websites will be hopelessly outdated the moment that it's released, that there is no appeal process against sites being blacklisted, and this is a particular concern where sites are inappropriately blacklisted, as happened during Senator Conroy's trial, and that child pornography is not distributed via the World Wide Web anyway. Speakers at Saturday's event in Melbourne included representatives of the Socialist Alliance, Electronic Frontiers Australia, the Pirate Party Australia, Exit International, the Australian Sex Party, and even random people from the crowd, who are all passionate about one thing, that Senator Conroy's net filter legislation must not see the light of day. Sex. The Australian Sex Party is a political movement promoting tolerance of free speech and sexual expression, which it considers are some of the main hallmarks of free and democratic nations. The ASP's Sarah Jenkins said that the secret and non-transparent nature of the proposed net filter and its so-called blacklist is a major cause for concern.
Basically, we as individuals will have no knowledge as to what goes on that blacklist. The blacklist will be contributed to by unelected officials who have no accountability. How do we know what they're putting on that filter and why it's going on there?
Ms. Jenkins identified that a lack of public scrutiny should also be a major cause for alarm, as should the unknown intentions of future governments.
current government does not abuse its rights, how do we know what future governments are going to do? We are not able to guarantee that no future government will not abuse their rights with this completely non-transparent filter.
Colin Jacobs from Electronic Frontiers Australia agreed, and by way of example, compared the blocking of a refused classification website to the current process for refusing classification to a movie.
This list that will be blocked will be secret, there'll be no appeal, there'll be no review. When a movie's banned in this country, it's a public decision. It can be appealed to the Classification Review Board. This is different, and we think we the people are what decide what the government can do ultimately. And if they want to take a new and secretive censorship power onto themselves, they have to make a really great case to the Australian people, and that case has really been left wanting.
Ms Jenkins from the ASP said that the government wanted to use the filter as a band-aid fix for what was a flawed classification system.
In addition to the filter's transparency issues and the fact that it just blatantly won't work, I believe that its basis in RC material is inherently flawed. We need to look at the classification itself and fix inherent problems before using it as the basis for more censorship. Making the online censorship process secret and unaccountable provides a scary precedent for censorship across the board, both in online and offline publications.
Trent Hawkins from the Socialist Alliance said that the government was trying to create a system of control over an unregulated medium.
It's not really about child pornography. It's not really about trying to stop pornography, although that will be one of the effects. It's actually trying to create a system of control over the internet. Like, it's no denying that the internet has improved the lives of people in the world by having space that they can freely discuss ideas, can communicate ideas to a broad audience, without having to pay money, without having to go through restrictions.
Patrick from the Socialist Alternative Party agreed. He said that the government was scaremongering Australians and using issues such as child pornography as an excuse to introduce a system which would have no bearing on the distribution of child pornography.
I think one of the most alarming developments in politics in recent years is a tendency for governments, both this government and its predecessor, to use public concern about pedophilia, child welfare, and child sexual abuse, to use this cynically as a pretext to introduce policies which will do nothing to protect children, which will do nothing to reduce instances of child sexual abuse, but will instead confer upon the government extraordinary powers over the citizen.
Colin Jacobs from Electronic Frontiers Australia agreed.
It's not to help anybody. It's not to accomplish anything for law enforcement. It's to target and exploit this feeling of unease. That's all it does. It's a political stunt. It makes people think that something is being done.
Patrick from the Socialist Alternative.
And I think what is most alarming about this legislation is it involves the government establishing the bureaucratic, legal and technological apparatus to be able to censor any views and information which displeases the government. This is a very alarming development. The government should not have the power to take information that it does not approve of and simply disappear it down the memory hole.
David Crafty from the Pirate Party Australia said that the solution to cyber safety was education and adult supervision, not a mandatory net filter.
The government states the aim of its internet censorship program is to protect the nation's children from mental harm. I and Pirate Party Australia believe that nobody is better placed to protect your children from mental harm than you, their parents. Personal filtering software such as NetNanny has been widely available at little cost for over a decade, allowing fine-grained control over what can be viewed on your own computers. For those of you with young children, I would encourage you to use this type of software. For all the previous government's faults, they subsidised this type of software for anyone who wanted it. We also recommend that children be taught about basic internet safety from an early age.
Mr Crafty said that while the proposed net filter would be flawed and ineffective from a technological point of view, its implementation would create a worrying precedent.
I'm an IT expert, so I know that the current filter plans are a joke. I'm personally not that concerned about the immediate effects of the proposed filter, because I know that I could get around it easily if I want, and I don't know of anything that the filter would block that I would really want to access anyway. My main concern stems from the fact that it establishes a framework upon which more censorship can be built, which will further erode our rights to privacy and freedom of speech. Version 1 might be a flimsy joke in practice, but the authority and ability will exist to create a more effective version down the line.
So, what did everyone think? Were the speakers preaching to the converted, or does the open internet movement still have more work to do?
Taking it to the streets on Tech Talk Radio.
Are you for or against the net filter?
I'm definitely against. I think it's taken away our mass free communication we have. And I think if they do, and I think it's a question of time, it'll turn into like what they did with radio and television, in the hands of a few.
What's your attitude towards the proposed net filter legislation?
I don't like it, so I'm here.
Okay, what is it that you don't like about it?
We have a nanny filter, they can use that instead.
It's not going to do anything, it's got no purpose, it's really not going to help anyone.
Can you see if the legislation is introduced that there would be any benefits towards having a net filter?
No, none the slightest, none.
If the legislation's introduced, do you see any good things coming out of it?
No.
Nothing at all?
No.
A few benefits, well, I guess we all would stay, I guess, dumb and uninformed because the internet's a great alternative media.
There's going to be good things from any bad move, so I'm not going to be an idiot and say nothing good will happen, but the bad greatly, greatly outweighs the good in this case.
Other than the abject failure of the filter to achieve any goals, increasing awareness about these issues amongst the general populace, no, I can't see any benefit.
What are the negatives that you see is coming out of the proposed legislation?
I think the biggest one's the obvious one. It's the obvious lack of public scrutiny of the filter. It's the lack of freedom, lack of free speech. It's a clear impingement on civil liberties and free speech and rights.
What are the bad things that would come out of the legislation being passed?
I already have my mother telling me what I can look at. I don't need the government telling me.
Well, how do you enforce it and what are the penalties? I think they're all serious issues and I think it's ridiculous. And good luck to the government for trying, but I can't see it working.
In its current form, the filter, it's going to slow down the internet. No one's denying that. They did a test about a year back and it blocked out some legitimate sites. It blocked out a dentist, it blocked out breast cancer, it blocked out some pro-gay sites. It's blocking out all kinds of stuff. It's completely non-transparent, which means that they're not going to publish the blacklist, they're not going to publish who decides what goes on the blacklist, they're not going to publish how the people who decide what goes on the blacklist were elected. There is no transparency and it's not Australian.
What do you think the government will be better off doing with its time and with our money?
Really, they could do anything. They could play croquet and be better off. Like, it's... As long as they don't do it, they're better off.
What do you think the government will be better off doing with its time and with its money?
Putting it into education and health, obviously.
I think the Greens Minister pointed out about a week ago that until this campaign came up, the government was funding a news at home net filter. I think it was Net Nanny, I'm not sure. And since then, this campaign's been ditched. That campaign is a perfectly justified in-home use filter, which would work perfectly well.
More police actually tracking, finding pedophiles. Health, education, all normal things that really a government should be doing and not restricting free speech.
The Howard government actually introduced a net nanny where parents could voluntarily download this thing that would block out stuff to prevent their children from going to certain sites. I think that was a great idea. It had a very low response, which either means that people didn't know about it or that people ultimately don't care that much about what their children see. They'd rather be in the room supervising than let them run free. And this filter, as it is, parents are going to think, oh, the filter will protect them and let them roam the internet by themselves. It's not even effective at blocking out the stuff it's trying to block out.
We've had a solution in place in the previous government that was voluntary. NetNanny software was available to anyone who wanted it. If you combined a more robust version of that program with increased internet safety education for children and parents and increased law enforcement resources to deal with the production of illegal material at the source, it would achieve the stated goals of the filter much better than what's been put in place.
That means we have to fight for that kind of government. It's not going to happen by accident. So we need more of these demonstrations. We need people on the streets to organise, not just on the internet, or just do that as well, but, you know, get out on the streets, get in the workplaces, my universities, among students, talk this up and try and get back here as soon as possible. And good on you all for coming here. Keep up the fight. Thanks a lot.
Entertaining, informative, and independent.
You're listening to Tech Talk Radio. You're listening to Tech Talk Radio, proudly sponsored by D-Link, building networks for people.
Well, it was a bit of a resounding sort of what came out in the survey was coming out of the rally there, I think, in a lot of respects.
And for the same reason, because they're tech-savvy people who were talking.
Captive audience, they knew why they were there and what they were there for, and hence the responses were largely all against the net filter proposal. But, Andrew, I thought it was interesting that you know that we're living in interesting times when a socialist says to you, we need to give more money to the police. I thought, this is quite amazing. And we had representatives there from lots of different political parties, including the Greens and the socialist movements. There were people who were not politically affiliated, like from the pro-euthanasia type lobby, they were there. And just random people from the crowd that said, I want to get up and I want to have a tell everybody about what I think about why the net filter shouldn't be introduced. I'm just a parent or I'm a teacher or whatever. So yeah, a lot of interesting arguments were made and it was a valuable exercise, but there's still a lot of work that needs to be done. Graeme's right, there's only 200 people or 300 people there. There needs to be 200 or 300,000 people that are aware of this issue, that are as passionate about it as everyone that was at the rally on Saturday. I'd like to hear from people, though. If you went to any of the others in Perth or Sydney or any other capital city, let us know. Feedback at techtalkradio.com.au. Let us know how it went.
Good. Yeah, come and tell us on the chat if you're listening to us live as well. All right, we're going to take a break. When we come back, Adam Turner catches up with Rosalind Cogan about potentially a new product to run up against the new Apple iPad, if and when that should, I think, maybe the end of April we were talking. Maybe. Yeah, yep. That'd be good. All right. Back with more in a moment.
You're listening to Australia's most informative technology show.
Tech Talk Radio.
Cast your mind back to the 90s.
This is a tad awkward, but not quite as bad as Dr. Ron's choice of music.
Anyway, I went in there and that...
Before we got distracted beautifully by that, I was going to talk about...
Somebody rings me every day at the moment to want to change my light globes.
Yep, that's it. It was a challenge and an opportunity, wasn't it?
I don't know. good. Glad you cleared the air on that one.
Yeah, it's out there.
Yeah, it is. As Mulder would say.
You're listening to Australia's most informative technology show. Tech Talk Radio. You're listening to Tech Talk Radio, proudly sponsored by D-Link, building networks for people.
Yes, have we mentioned our thanks to D-Link? Because they sponsor us. Good stuff too. I've got a lot of their products, even before they sponsored us. So there you go. You're listening to Tech Talk Radio. Dr. Ron, Andrew, Graeme, JD in this evening. And Warlock is on Fader 1 on a Skype connection somewhere in up north somewhere. Yes, well done on that little sort of field excursion there, Dr. Ron. Was it... That was before the skies opened, wasn't it?
It was before the skies, the heavens opened,
that
yes, and we all got washed away.
It was very strange. We got sunburned at the rally and then hailed on the way home. So.
Yes. Almost had our windscreen smashed by hailstone or golf balls the size of hailstones or something.
Something like that.
Yeah.
Scary.
What would be good to do is to talk to some the average Joe blogs in the street about what their impressions are about the proposed net filter legislation. We should do that very soon. Just get some real off the street, rather than the captive audience stuff at that sort of a rally.
I can tell you what you'll find out.
And they'll say, huh?
They'll say, what? What filter? What do you mean?
What filter? Oh, net nanny. Oh, that's to stop pornography. That's a good idea.
Yeah, exactly.
Yes.
So they'll either not know about it, or they'll think it's a good idea.
There really needs to be an education process undertaken.
It does,
really, doesn't
yes.
it? Like it needs to have pages taken out. And this is what I would have thought EFA, and I'm not sort of dobbing them into being an agency that does this, but... You need some organisation which draws the general public's attention to what it is. I guess we're trying to do that tonight, but even our listeners are traditionally, I know that I think they're more tech savvy than average without wanting to do anything. Yeah, anyway.
Most people that I asked about what the government should be doing instead of trying to introduce a net filter, most people said education and putting money into law enforcement. That seemed to be the most popular responses. That would be a better effort, they felt, than trying to introduce a technological solution.
And I noticed also they were talking about the net nanny filtering. That seemed to be quite topical.
That was mentioned a lot. Yeah.
From the
government's point of view, of course, that filter is a failure because there was publicity about some 12-year-old was able to work around it. Now, what everybody's missed about that is that the solution is that you put
you put the net filter software on the computer and you put the computer in the lounge room and you watch what your kids are doing.
Correct.
Because, you know, any filter, if you've got user access physically to the computer, you can work around it. That's not the point. The point is to prevent...
It's the first line of defense, isn't it?
It's the first line of defense. It's to prevent a user accidentally going to a site that's going to be offensive. Okay, that's what you're trying to protect your 12-year-old against.
But like everything else, you need to keep it updated as well. Now, absolutely. I don't know whether NetNanny got any updates, but like a virus software program, need to keep it updated. Yeah.
Kaspersky has a child filter in his software, and I'm sure others do as well. So there might be another option out there for those that want to go down that path.
Most of the,
and you probably got it already.
Well, or you've got the antivirus product for which there's a more advanced, generalized security suite that you can get. Yeah. Now, for most of my customers that are adult individual computer users, I recommend against going for the security suite. But if you've got kids using the computer, it's probably a good idea. If you're using the Kaspersky antivirus, upgrade yourself to the Kaspersky security suite, and you get the filtering for adult content as well.
Excellent. Many ways,
a lot of other things.
Many ways to skin that cat.
Absolutely.
If you want to have as a closing remark on this topic tonight, if you want to have a look at the results of that broadband survey that was conducted by Whirlpool or Broadband Choice, you point your web browser at whirlpool.net.au/survey/2009, and you'll see all the results there. But we'll put a link to that in the show notes as well.
Now, Dr. Ron, you disturbed me earlier on this evening talking about strange emails that you were getting from Inga from Sweden. No,
it wasn't Inga. It was Alina from Texas.
Would it surprise you that January was a record high month for phishing globally in internet world? January marked a record high for the number of phishing attacks, seeing a 21% increase over the month before. This is according to RSA in the United States. The firm's monthly online fraud report showed a record phishing attacks reached an all-time high of 18,820, more than double the figure a year ago. Fast flux attacks in January accounted for 24% of phishing incidents, up 4% from December, and standard phishing attacks show a 12% increase compared to that of December. Now, if anyone can tell me what a fast flux attack is, I'd love to know, because maybe it's just a new term I'm not familiar with, and there'll be others out there probably the same.
Fast flux is a DNS technique used by botnets to hide phishing and malware delivery sites, says Wikipedia. It's all there.
Now, I can only speak for what's been trying to get through and into my inbox, which, as you guys know, my inbox is fairly locked down at the best of times. But I've seen there's phishing for CUA, the credit union. That comes in every half hour or so until I physically had to put something in the mail server to stop people. And it was the little Trojans attachments. And there's a lot of these JPEGs coming through again too, which if you open them and don't click on them, people, I would believe they would have graphics drawing you to medication websites and things like that that springing up again.
Both at work and home, where normally I don't get a lot of spam, I've been getting lots and lots of drug company spam.
Yeah, have they worked out a way of getting through again? I noticed even some of the Gmail stuff I've got of late, Gmail's been letting it through, so I don't know how they're doing it.
Mm. It's a constant ebb and flow. Whenever anyone comes up with a better way to filter, the spammers will try and come up with a way to work around it. So it'll always have this sort of come in waves as the balance shifts towards one or the other of the bad guys or the good guys.
Now, Dr. Ron, you were talking, and I've got an article here too, about the spam bots that got the Spanish bots, which was quite potentially damaging to the world's email systems. But Spanish criminals who stole bank details from computers around the world didn't realize the power of the illegal network they had created, which could have paralyzed the entire country's computer systems. Now, this is according to the local Spanish police.
Yeah, that's what the Spanish police said. They said, thank goodness that they hadn't realized the full potential of this network, and they only used the network to harvest credit card details and bank account details. There were 13 million computers they identified had actually been compromised.
Now, is this all in Spain, I'm assuming, or is this
globally? No, this is worldwide in 190 countries, and PCs from at least 100 companies in Australia had so far been identified as having been compromised. So potentially thousands and thousands of Australian computers have been infected by, become part of this botnet.
Now, Graham, would a normal antivirus software package or something like that pick up the fact that you were infected, or how would somebody know?
Once the the details become publicly known, then certainly your antivirus is going to pick that up. Some antivirus products have ways of detecting unusual activity, so that they might detect that there's something on your computer doing DNS lookups when there's no other logical reason for the computer to be doing them, and it might flag that as being a warning event saying something odd's going on here. Mm. So, yes, the answer is yes, and, of course, once it's become general knowledge that this particular software exists, then they will all immediately be releasing an update to detect it, because the updates, of course, come out now every day or you know, often several times a day.
Now, here at Tech Talk Radio, we're friends of Microsoft. We've had Microsoft on the program. We all use Microsoft products here, but please do not use Internet Explorer ever for any reason. It's silly. And
unless you have to, of course. There are some things that Internet Explorer does do well, like talking to Outlook Web Access or talking to certain websites that have been written specifically to use it.
Unless you absolutely
can
have to.
Can I add another flavour? If you ever have to log into Telstra for your account, can I suggest you use IE, because nothing else displays the Telstra login properly once
doesn't
you get your account. Yeah.
The reason why I say that is
which is silly, Telstra. Lift your game. Come on, other browsers, please.
Yes.
The criminals that wrote the virus that sucked all these machines into the botnet exploited a vulnerability in Microsoft's Internet Explorer browser. So had people been using an alternate browser, chances are that they wouldn't have been infected. The news article said that this then allowed the criminals to record keystrokes and login credentials. So there's lots of other browsers out there. We in here all use Chrome, we use Firefox, we use Safari,
yep,
JD.
Correct. Safari and Firefox.
There's lots of other web browsers out there which don't have the same or don't attract the same type of scrutiny that Internet Explorer does.
And it's not that they're inherently more secure in a lot of cases. I mean, any software can have programming errors in it, what is called in the business bugs. So any software can experience that and have security problems.
That's what the new versions do, don't they?
That's
release
why there's
new fixes.
Always releases and fixes and updates. Yep. But the bad guys tend to target Internet Explorer's vulnerabilities specifically, just because that's the majority of what people are using
out
there.
The weakest link.
So if you're not using the majority web browser, you're immediately in a better situation.
Use Safari.
Safari is Apple's web browser, but it's also available for Windows, so you're quite happy to use that on your Windows 7 machine or your Windows XP machine. Don't use your Vista machine, because you've thrown that out the window by now, I hope. Chrome is one that I use an awful lot, and it's really good because it's really fast. It launches quickly, it responds quickly, it opens a new tab really quickly, it does everything really
Firefox
quickly.
Firefox used to be quick, and then it didn't.
Firefox.
Firefox
is a great browser if you want to add on lots of extra things. If you use an add-on to monitor your net usage or to show you your ISP bandwidth remaining, or you use one of the add-ons that downloads stuff automatically for you, or any of those add-ons for Firefox, then you know there's nothing like Firefox for being expandable and to be able to add things to it. So Firefox is great for that.
I find it gives me grief with Windows 7 at the moment. Firefox and it's a bit like oil and water. They just don't work, whereas Chrome is just slick.
I'd be very surprised if that's a more general problem, is it?
Says he looking at me. No, I've just noticed that all the machines in the office since we went to 3.5.8 or something, they've been very sluggish in responding to the new Firefox. But it might just be me. It might be others. Maybe people out there in the chat can tell us their experiences if they're using Firefox and Windows 7. But
I haven't tried. I'm a bit of a Chrome addict.
I must admit, I decided that, yes, I was going to move to the Chrome world. That was the straw that broke the camel's back the other night. So I've now loaded up Chrome on absolutely everything.
Now, you used to be one of those ones that had a few add-ons, though.
My main add-ons that I like, you can also now get for Chrome. So I was very
happy
really? About that,
Oh, that's
yes.
good. Oh, well, there you go.
So hence that was the reason for the
move. What add-ons do you use on Chrome?
X Marks.
Yep. Oh, this is portable bookmarking. This is synchronized bookmarking.
Bookmarking between devices, yes.
So you have your same bookmarks at home and on your laptop and at your computer.
Yeah. So if I find something that I need for work, I can just bookmark it, and guess what? It's on the work machine the next morning when I log in. So very handy.
It's also cross-browser, isn't it?
Yes. X Marks. It works on Firefox and Chrome, and I think there's actually some new extensions for other browsers, but I was very happy when it came up.
So if you use Firefox at home and Chrome at work,
it'll still do the handshake, which is very handy. So, and that's I think was just came out of beta the other day with X Marks, but yeah, anyway,
sounds like a good one.
All right. Now, in other interesting news, Apple iPad to spur growth in the tablet market. Well, like everything that Apple tends to do, we tend to get a plethora of devices. And
Me too.
Yeah, exactly. A lot of people would just want a tablet now for no other reason than the Joneses have got one and they want to keep up with the Joneses.
Well, Apple have shown people with a tablet you can do this and it's good for this reason. So, yeah. Now, other people think, well, I want a tablet now, but I don't want to pay Apple prices for it.
That's right.
You pay a certain premium to have that logo on it.
But I thought tablets had been and gone. We had tablets like 5 or 6 or 7 years ago.
Yeah, they were never very practical.
They never took off. They were never practical. Well, no one ever used them as tablets. They folded the screen out and used them as laptops. Ultimately.
I think one of the interesting things, though, we use tablets where I work for a lot of data entry every day.
It's different types of tablets, too.
There is. And these things are Panasonic Toughbooks, so people can use the screen, but they never do.
Yeah,
they always type into them, so it's really a laptop, it's not a tablet. And when I was in Darwin recently, we were looking at an application that's being developed to do a certain thing for work, and they were using a stylus-based phone. And I'm thinking, well, that's yesterday now. I want to be able to push a button with my finger on the phone. And I think that's the thing with the old tablets, is that they are all based around a pen, so you had to either write into it or tap on something on the screen, like my old XDA2 phone, my old
iMate
XDA2. Phone. We've all had that sort of HTC device here.
We have.
Whereas the new version tablets that are coming out, and the iPad's a good example, is again like the iPhone, uses your finger for multi-touch, and you can point at stuff and pretend it's a typewriter with your fingers, which most of the older tablets, say from a decade ago, you needed to use a stylus.
Mm.
But isn't, I think it's just a different mindset of typing on a piece of glass, which effectively is what these tablets are. So you don't actually touch keys. It's just a different way of driving a computer, and we have to get into that way of thinking, don't we?
That's another one of the two big differences between Apple's tablet and the previous tablets we've had in the past is, one, the tablets we've had in the past have always had a fold-out keyboard that you can get to optionally.
That's right, Gray.
The other difference is the stylus, the pen that you had to use. So they're the two big differences.
Now, the one I was thinking of...
Apple have always been good at taking an idea and making it practical in one way or another.
I used to work for a distributor that sold the Fujitsu Lifebook series, and they had exactly what Graham's describing. They had the screen which you could sort of swivel, and you could cover up the keyboard and use it as a tablet, or you could swivel it around and open it up, and you could use it as a conventional
laptop.
Yeah, but the whole tablet thing never took off. But we'll wait and see what happens with Apple's.
But also, and I don't know about the current version of the tablet Windows or Windows for tablets, but the older version was just the same. It was Windows, and it had the same interface, and it expected you to do things in the same way. I think one of the important things about a new tablet is that you need to have the user interface customized for use as a tablet, not just a PC that happens to now have touch sensitivity about it. So, for example, the iPhone is quite different to the macOS operating system that we used to on a laptop, but it's actually the same operating system underneath. It's the user interface that's completely different. And I think that's one of the things we'll find with the iPad is, hopefully, Apple have got the user interface right, that you only have to type when it's necessary and everything else is available to you relatively easily.
And that's why they're using the iPhone iTouch software rather than the full Mac OS software. Is that what you're thinking there?
That's right, except there is, of course, in the press release and the demos already, the iWork application. So there is a word processor, there is a spreadsheet, I think, and a couple of other of the iWork products being ported across. Because that's what people are expecting to do on these larger devices, to be able to use them as a word processor or a simple spreadsheet, and for presentations as well.
And does this mean that everybody's going to have to install Velcro on their knees, on their jeans, and then the opposite, the Velcro hooks on the back of the
It's a slippery sucker, isn't it? That's what you're alluding to.
Of the iPad, so you can stick it to your knees and be able to type with two hands.
Yeah, you're probably right, although you know the reality is there's not many iPhones. Mine's an exception, but there's not many iPhones that don't have a silicone case on them already or something else.
Mine doesn't.
To help increase their grippability.
Stick them in place, yeah. Mm. Mm.
And there'll be other things that flatten the bottom of them so that they don't rock on the table and those sorts of things.
So do you think that what Apple did to telephony with the iPhone and, I guess, PDAs, is going to happen again with these new tablets?
It'll be interesting to see. We've obviously got an article coming up about the Kogan device, and we know about the Kindle. So there's a few other things in the market at the moment. So, you know, if Apple are good enough to spark the market and generate a new direction for technology, then, you know, all well and good.
The history is that Apple's products either tend to do really, really well or really, really badly. So
have you got a Newton?
We'll find out.
I actually bought a Newton when they were new. Yes.
Newtons were...
one of the few.
I do know somebody else who has a Newton as well, but they were a little palm device, really, that you held and you had a pen and you could. It did handwriting recognition.
Yeah, they
like
sparked
that.
The term PDA back in the 90s. The nice thing about the Newton is that they, again, the user interface was quite different to Apple's operating system of the day. It did some really smart things that, in fact, even the iPhone hasn't picked up on. So it did some smart analysis of what you entered. So if you wrote into it, now, you know, the handwriting bit was always a bit of a catch for the Newton. By the last version, it was improved, but by then, you know, too many people knew about the history. But if you wrote in that you wanted to have lunch with Jane tomorrow, it picked out Jane, who you had lunch with most often, out of your diary and set up the appointment for tomorrow at lunchtime and said, is this what you meant? And you hit OK. And 99 times out of 100, it was right.
Oh, that's interesting.
So some really smart things in the old Newton operating system that haven't come across yet.
But look at voice recognition. Like, you would have thought that would have come of age a little bit. And maybe it has in certain applications. But, you know, I still fight it today, says he, holding up his iPhone again. Like, I tried to call Dr. Ron when I had service on the way home this evening, and I spoke to my device and I said, please call Dr. Ron on his mobile, and it rang Graham instead. You know, and I just think that we're still missing out on some of this, what I would have thought would be fairly fundamental. Like, if it didn't know what you wanted, maybe it would say unclear and ask again or something. I didn't catch that, but no, it just chooses to dial someone at random, which can catch you on an earpiece, let me tell you, when you go, oh, I didn't mean to ring you.
That's speaker-independent voice recognition that the iPhone's doing, is it? So you haven't trained it
learn
that a particular contact is Dr. Ron and you've spoken name.
No, it's all learnt it all by itself. So anyway. All right, Adam Turner, he caught up with Ruslan Kogan recently, last week, in fact, in Sydney. I think it was Sydney. And anyway, Ruslan's going to bring out something which is... similar ilk to the iPad. And anyway, we'll let Adam and Roslyn take it from here.
So we've taken the view from the couch on the road again. We're at the Kickstart Technology Conference in Queensland, and I am talking to Ruslan Kogan, who is the head of Kogan Technologies, and we have a tablet PC here. Ruslan, do you want to tell us a bit about it?
Thanks, Adam. It's a tablet PC that Kogan plans to launch very shortly. It's going to be priced at $199, which I think is one of the main selling points of the device. It'll be preloaded with three different operating systems. So we're going to have the Android OS, we're going to have Ubuntu, and we're going to have Windows CE on it. And when you start up the device, you just choose which OS you want. Some of the great features on it is the fact that it can output full HD video. And, you know, it's got quite a bit of connectivity options in terms of USB and Bluetooth and things like that. The device has quite a nice form as well, so it's a nice-looking device. And it will be in that tablet market space.
What's the size of the screen?
It's a 7-inch screen which runs an 800 by 480 resolution.
And how do you envision that people might use it?
That's a very good question. It's actually one of those devices where I myself am thinking, well, what are people going to be doing with it? I know, for instance, my mum at the moment, you see her in the kitchen always, you know, running back and forth between the study, trying to, you know, get a certain recipe and altering a recipe and things like that, because people wouldn't really want to have a netbook or something like that on their kitchen bench. It might get, you know, a bit of flour in it or dirty and things like that. A device like this, it's got a little stand at the back. You just stand it up. You can browse through a recipe, use dirty fingers on it, then just wipe the screen down when you're done. That's one use I can think of it. The rest is really, you know, we've never seen this form before. I'd want to see users show us how they're going to use such a device. I personally, as I was saying even before, this would be one product that Kogan launches that I don't know if I'd use for myself, because I've got an Android phone, I've got a Kogan netbook, and they pretty much, you know, fulfill all my mobile needs. So I'd love to see how people start using this sort of device, because one thing's for certain is there's definitely demand out there. We've had so many people email us and call us and request it the demand's out there. That's why we're putting it on the marketplace, but I want to know how people are going to use it.
And when are we likely to see it on sale?
Depends how many people start telling us what they're going to use it for. We have the capacity to have this product in the market by, you know, within a month. If people start contacting us or posting on our blog post saying, look, this is a great device and here's what I'm going to do with it and here's the advantages that it adds, then yeah, we're ready to go full throttle and put this in the marketplace. But at this stage, you know, we're not in too much of a rush because I'm struggling to see exactly how this product is going to be used. I'm not saying there isn't a future for this sort of device, but, you know, what's all the hype about? Why is everyone requesting them? Like, at this stage, all the people have said is, yeah, I want one, but no one's actually been able to articulate what they're going to do with it.
Great, thank you for your time.
Thanks, Adam.
Entertaining, informative, and independent. You're listening to Tech Talk Radio.
Funny, isn't it? People just don't know what they're going to do with a tablet.
Well, it worries me that a company's decided to go and design something just because somebody else did and don't know what to do with it.
But wouldn't Apple not know what to do with it? I must admit, I did take somewhat of a stance against Steve Jobs when he got up there and said, we don't think the netbook is much. We built the iPad instead. Mm. I thought, hang on a minute. I'd much rather take a netbook somewhere and use a netbook to do what I needed to do. Having said that, I haven't seen, touched, felt, or played with one of these new devices yet. But, you know, the netbook is just a very small, compact thing, which gives me, you know, 6 hours worth of battery, which has got to be good.
And look, I don't want to sound as though I'm defending him, but it will come out that way. I think the interesting thing from Steve's point of view is he's always said that he doesn't want to get in the netbook market because he doesn't believe he could make a laptop at that price and still have quality, which is probably a reasonable statement. If you look at the iPad, it actually isn't a netbook. It's not a cut-down
laptop. Oh, he doesn't say it is.
Laptop. It's actually a large phone or a large...
Well, it hasn't got a phone in it.
iPod Touch, for example.
Yes.
So it's not a cut-down laptop. It's a built-up portable device.
It's got big buttons for the visually impaired too, I've noticed.
All of those sorts of things, yeah. So, I mean, it's interesting. I'm sure Apple have got their ducks in a row, so to speak. You know, the Newton, the Lisa, the Apple III, all the things that failed in the past, even the quick-take cameras that I really like, they've learned from their mistakes, and certainly Steve wasn't around for a lot of those. Well, a couple he was. But if you look at the iPhone, they've obviously been working on it for probably the best part of a decade, but picked the right time to market it, obviously, if we look at what's happened. Same with the iPod, and they're coming good with their laptop and desktop machines. So I'd be surprised if they haven't got some killer apps and an idea about how this thing's going to be used. And their early marketing, obviously, has generated lots of hype and interest, which is great.
Oh, as the Apple juggernaut does when
now,
it launches.
Now, it never used to.
When it launches things, yeah.
Now, there's one other thing that the Apple juggernaut tends to do very well, and it's probably less productive, and that's legal action.
Oh, yes.
Now, what is going on? Apple have decided to sue HTC.
Correct. Apple has sued Taiwan's HTC, which make touchscreen smartphones using Google software, for infringing 20 hardware and software patents related to the iPhone. Even though the suit did not name Google as a defendant, Apple's move was viewed by many analysts as proxy for an attack on the internet company
whose Nexus
One smartphone is manufactured by HTC.
Because all the things that they're claiming to be patented are user interface features like the double touch and that sort of stuff. Mm. And, you know, they're all operating system features, not hardware features. So why are Apple going after HTC, a relatively small hardware company,
Instead of Google,
who produced the operating system that's really at heart responsible.
Would it surprise you that Google's probably got deeper pockets than Apple does?
Than HTC?
Yes. Well, beg your pardon, yes.
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. And, yeah, I think it's a little bit...
Mr. Jobs used some fighting words. He said he thinks that competition is healthy, but competitors should create their own original technology and not steal ours.
Yeah, but there's some things that are so basic and obvious that, I mean, trying to patent them is just...
Well, some of the patents in dispute were unlocking a device by performing a gesture on an unlock image. How do you get these patents to start with? As you say, they're so fundamental and basic and obvious.
Yes.
But so was the mouse.
Was the mouse...
and there was a similar patent issue you might remember in the 80s. So. Mm.
There's a system and method for managing power conditions within a digital camera device. Apple say that HTC is infringing that patent. Conserving power... A system and method for managing power conditions within a digital camera device.
Oh, how broad is that allegation?
Yeah, so if you make any sort of camera device and there's power management software or power management system in place, then that's infringing their patent.
Let's draw a parallel with the motor vehicle industry. Let's talk about braking technology.
Yes, a system that slows the car down by applying a braking system to the wheels. Yeah, yeah.
Hello?
Now, how about this one for broad? An object-oriented graphic system.
Sorry, say that again?
An object-oriented
graphic
system.
Well, let's talk about any PC software or any Mac software around. It's all graphic-based.
Well, Apple say that HTC is infringing its patent.
Okay, this will be an interesting one to go through the court system, won't it?
Yep, there's another one.
And that's probably why they're not targeting Google.
Absolutely, that's why they're not targeting Google, and I'm criticising them for it. Pick on someone your own size.
Yeah, poor old HTC.
Exactly.
Yes, they're also Apple's seeking a permanent exclusion order, which would prohibit HTC from importing infringing devices and components. So anything existing at the moment, you can't bring it in. Stop it. You're infringing our patent, says Apple.
Well, the other thing that's probably worth mentioning at this time too is the Wi-Fi patent that the CSIRO successfully contested.
Now, that's a bit different.
Most of the major manufacturers... Yeah, exactly.
Because that's not simple and it's not obvious.
And it was the first of its kind.
Unlocking a device by a gesture on the screen, which... I mean, how else are you going to unlock a touch device?
The same as you can on any other phone. You type in a PIN number.
It's absolutely insane. But, yeah, with Wi-Fi, I mean, that was a complex problem that needed a complex and detailed solution that took a lot of research.
And a historical
and
situation, too.
And that's what patents are for.
Correct.
Is to protect people who do the fundamental research and solve these complex problems. It's not for people who say, we've got a touch device, let's unlock it with a touch gesture.
Or it has objects on the display, you're not allowed to touch those objects.
That's right, yeah. I mean, for goodness sake.
So potentially we can see what new and wonderful gizmos and gadgets are coming out by just keeping an eye on the RSS feed from the patents office in the United States.
Oh, well, yes.
Well, people do that already.
Absolutely.
Except that you'll get a lot of patents for really insane devices and you'll never be able to sift the good stuff from the dodgy.
Absolutely. But yes, the CSIRO successfully took most of the majors to court and won, and they now have got quite a cash injection into their research, which is potentially good for the CSIRO, because that was all developed out of the war radars and things like that, which was pretty amazing sort of technology for its time. And then others nicked it, and they got their own back recently. That was late last year, if I recall, so... Anyway, now should we move on? Now we've mentioned Google. We should actually move into a few things. The Google juggernaut, because they're all juggernauts. These guys are just too big for their boots, apparently. A couple of interesting things. Locally, IT News, one of the local online websites, published an article during the course of the week saying that they had found Google Australia's secret data network. Now, they use the word secret loosely.
It's not very secret if it's in the IT News websites, is it?
No, exactly. But allegedly, they have a cage in Sydney, which has just got a few servers in it. And I don't know whether that makes news or not, but IT News seem to think it does. But it's just like the company...
It would absolutely stun me if Google didn't have equipment in a few data centers scattered around the place.
Absolutely. So they've got, I believe, according to something else we'll hear in just a few minutes, around 450,000 servers, I think, was the current last... Count.
Around
so
the world, yeah.
Got to have a few here.
Yeah.
Whether they're all in Sydney in a cage, I
and
doubt
it's
it.
It's not unusual for companies to have isolated networks that aren't on the internet to do research and development. So
that's true too.
Yes, that's very true. Now, Google has also launched gesture search, speaking of turning phones off with gestures and things like that. Now, this is only available in the US, I believe, and also available on some Android products, Dr. Ron.
Yes, listening up.
Google has released new mobile search tools designed to boost user productivity. The new gesture search functionality is a Google Labs application for devices running Android 2 in various countries. Google said that this means that only UK users of the Motorola Droid and Milestone handsets would currently have access to the functionality.
Oh.
So, say you wanted to call your friend Anne, just open the gesture search and draw the letter A, and the gesture search returns a list of items that, you know, has A. Now, I'm just wondering, we had recently, and once again, this goes back to all the patent things, I think one of our guests was talking about it. It's really a fair while ago. But remember, you used to do the letter A with your mobile? Is that one and the same thing? Like you'd have a device and you'd draw the letter A in the air.
Oh, okay.
And this is a very similar sort of thing.
Oh, yeah, what was that? Someone had a device with that you were drawing in midair.
Like with a little Wii controller, that's
no, with your handset.
No, with your... That's right,
your handsets have got, accelerometers in them now, yeah.
Anyway,
I can't remember what that device was. This does actually sort of lean itself to one thing that I noticed with my Android-powered phone, possibly with any phone like this that has a desktop, and that's desktop real estate. And it fills up fast. And I've got my my desktop, if you like, or my my front screen of my Android-powered phone, and it's got 4x4 icons there, so 16 icons on the screen. The screen's full. I can't add any more.
Same as the iPhone.
Yeah, but I use each and every one of those icons, and I've thought to myself more than once recently, I wish I could have a bigger screen, or I wish I could make the icons smaller and fit more shortcuts in.
Third-party app.
Get an iPad.
Get an iPad.
Yeah, try and put that in your pocket and carry it around.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Now, I can sort of slide around, and I can go to the screens either side, and I can put extra icons there. But I've often thought, there's only a limited amount of space here.
Have a look around. In the jailbreak section for the iPhone, you can actually get apps that will then condense, so you can do 5x5 or 6x6 apps on the screen. I'd be really surprised if someone hasn't done it for the Android.
Interesting. But this might solve this problem, Andrew. You can gesture at the device, or gesture on the device, and
correct,
say I do a big A for Andrew or a big G for Graham if I want to call
it's,
him.
It's
or,
in labs, so it'll probably stay in beta for some time. It might roll out to other devices, but watch this space. If you're in the UK, we've got Darren in the UK. He's on our chat at the moment. Maybe he's got a device that caters for this. Maybe you can test it out for us, see if it works.
So if you Google the words Google Android gesture or gesture search, you'll find lots of literature there online about it. Android users, get ready to give your phone the finger, says one article here, and it's got a bit of a couple of screen grabs there as to what it might be going to look like.
Mm.
Very good.
All right.
So it's not just a cheap graffiti type letter recognition system, is it, where you just write the letter on the screen?
That's what it looks like. It looks like you just write the letter on the screen. You tell it, if I write this letter, then this is what I want the thing to do.
Mm. Which Palm took over. The graffiti operating system at one point.
Now, whilst we're on the subject of Google, Google obviously has grown considerably in its 10 years that it's been a fledgling little thing in the backyard with the two boys. It's now really probably the biggest internet company in the world. Google stepped up its assault on Microsoft's productivity software with the acquisition of a startup company that allows Microsoft users to edit and share their documents on the web. Google said on a company blog last Friday that it has acquired San Francisco-based Docverse. So is this just another to keep the competitors at bay, or is this
another acquisition?
Yeah.
Docverse.
Yeah.
What did Docverse do, or what does Docverse do?
With Docverse, people can begin to experience some of the benefits of web-based collaboration using the traditional Microsoft Word, Excel, and PowerPoint desktop applications.
Oh, yeah, Google, divide already, and conquer, that's all right.
Absolutely. Now,
already half a dozen other things that do that, yeah.
Having said that, Hungry Beast, during the course of last week, ran a very thought-provoking piece of material, which I'm about to play a bit of audio of in just a few moments, really highlighting what Google has achieved over the past 10 years. Thought-provoking is where I'd like to point it, and we'll talk about it after this.
Google. The noun that became a verb. The world's favourite search engine. The company whose motto is, don't be evil. Google processes 1 billion web searches every day using 450,000 servers. But it's more than just a search engine. Intel CEO Andy Grove calls Google, which has a market value of $200 billion, a company on steroids with a finger in every industry. Google has acquired 30 other companies in the last 9 years and patented 187 products. Last year, it launched a venture capital arm to invest in software, clean tech, biotech, healthcare, and no doubt other areas we haven't thought of yet. Here's a few of the things Google wants to own: your phone, your email, your computer, and your entire digital life. Whatever you want to do online, Google wants to be your one-stop shop. It also wants to own the cables that deliver the internet itself and the electricity to power them. Google also wants to provide your entertainment and your news. It wants to build the largest library ever. This project is currently the subject of a class action lawsuit brought by publishers and authors. And it wants to know where everything is, from your front lawn all the way to Mars. Google wants to track you, storing records of everything you look at online for 18 months. It also wants access to your health records and your DNA, with two of its early investments in genetic testing companies. Google wants to follow your friendships,
Social media platform Google Buzz was engulfed in complaints last month over alleged privacy breaches. It is now the subject of another class action lawsuit. And it's not the first time that privacy has been an issue. Google Maps and Google Earth have been criticised for including photos of naked kids, people vomiting, and leaving sex shops. 2 months ago, Google CEO Eric Schmidt said of privacy concerns, "If you have something you don't want anyone to know, maybe you shouldn't be doing it in the first place." Why does Google want to know so much about you? As Schmidt says, "We are in the advertising business. 97% of its revenue comes from ads. Google wants to know who you are, where you are, and what you like, so it can target ads at you." Google, building an empire on your street, on your phone, in your DNA, trying very hard not to be evil.
Sounds like 1984 to me.
Food for thought or what?
I thought,
go and have a look at that, everyone. If you go and jump on iView and have a bit of a look-see, well worth seeing the graphics that go with it. Brilliant report. Well done to Hungry Beast for drawing that attention to people. But it does. It raises a lot of questions. And I think people do believe that, oh, yeah, Google are fine. Google are fine. And Google is basically going down the path that it chooses to do. No one's sort of saying yes, no, otherwise, or questioning them as they go. But if you think about it, it's becoming a very, very powerful company because it holds the cards. Now, it's got all the information to its chest. What if it fell into the wrong hands, if someone stole something from them or whatever, what safeguards are in place to prevent?
In the bad old days in Australia, you wouldn't be allowed to own that much content in a variety of different media. So, the old media laws, which meant that you could only own a certain percentage of the media in the country, so you didn't get a monopoly view. Google seemed to have actually got around all of that internationally, which is interesting.
Mm. So maybe that's it. Maybe it's the tyranny of international law, which I guess like going into outer space, really. Is it who controls outer space? No one, really, do they? So is this, I don't know. It's food for thought. Dr. Ron, you got any opinions on
the Empire? I'm interested to hear that they want to take over utilities. And I thought, oh, that's a bit odd. But then I thought, well, it's not really odd because they're going to want to control internet service delivery so that they have some quality control over being a service provider and providing people with internet services. I thought, well, if they're controlling that sort of infrastructure, then it would make sense that they would then expand to be controlling other things like power and other distribution.
There was a patent and some diagrams a year ago or more around some large container ships that Google was going to use as their server farms and have them out in international waters, interestingly enough. But also there was attached to that the use of waveform to power them. So you have the big booms out, and there was on Catalyst or Quantum or one of those shows recently where you can use the power of waves to generate electricity,
yeah,
which they would then use to power the floating server farms. So there's a range of things that sort of have been around the media for the last year or two where Google have been involved in that sort of thing.
My other point is that any company the size of Google is going to be looking to diversify. It's perfectly natural for a company that size. And if you are doing a whole lot of stuff, but it's all narrowly focused on the internet, it's natural for a very big company to want to say, well, let's do something in a slightly different field just for the sake of diversifying the investment. So let's buy some utilities or other things. I mean, Channel 7 not long ago bought a business that's primarily involved in mining in Western Australia. So it's just diversification.
It's valid. But I also think Justin's comments earlier were also very valid too about media ownership.
Oh, yeah. And look, I'm sure there's multiple reasons why a company that size does anything, not just for one reason.
You look at, and if you look at a lot of other companies and their historical travel, you look at Adobe. Adobe is one of divide and conquer. Photoshop, which is probably their flagship software, was not originally by Adobe. It was by a company called Aldus. And they had Photoshop 3.
That's what they had, Elder's Photo Styler in the good old days.
And it was such a great thing that they got bought out and then Adobe bought it.
And Microsoft are masters at this. Google are masters at this. If anything's doing something that interests you, you buy them out and either use their product or kill it off, one or the other. Yeah.
And I guess that's my point, really. At what point do we allow a company to take world domination
in a particular field.
Well, there's no world government to stop that from going on. But the American government and the European government are both fairly strong on what the Americans call antitrust and what we would call anti-competitive behaviour. It's, you know, there are some checks and balances there in the very large markets, particularly in Europe. They're very strong on this sort of stuff. So, although internationally there's no rules that are obviously holding them back, there are in their major markets, and I think there are some controls there that we're ignoring. The other thing, if I can just counter one of Justin's points coming out of that a while back, Justin said something about Big Brother. There's one very, very big difference between Big Brother and Google, and that is that Google is not the state. So there is still
a
separate,
corporation, which is
right.
Even scarier, actually.
Well, it's scarier in one way and less scary in another way. So, yeah, there's still a separate state structure that might be able to control it.
Can I draw a parallel to Telstra in this country?
Yeah.
If you look at what the government's doing over a monopoly of broadband, they're going to split the company up. Why? Because they had too much of a controlling interest in a lot of areas.
Hmm.
Now, what's not to say that Google has similar interests in what they do?
And Google certainly do have interests in things like broadband networks and so on. It's Google either buy or own a lot of capacity on the big international interlinks.
Oh, absolutely.
Interesting what's going on.
I guess the
Australia,
bottom line is
say, yeah.
someone, something, some government, someone needs to make sure that Google continues to do good, I think is where we're coming from, because they have so much.
Well, hang on a minute. Google don't have to continue to do good. That's the Google are a company. What they're required to do is to...
They're required to make money.
They're required, in Australia and in lots of other places in the world, they're required to act in the best interest of their shareholders, which usually is interpreted as making money, yeah.
Yeah, but to sell... I know, I'm just picking things at random here. To sell lists or to sell information that they have, which we've given to them, because the American laws are different to the Australian laws. Mm. And I'll give you an example of opting in and opting out. In the United States, people can add you to a mailing list without any... And you have to opt out to it, whereas over here in Australia, it's the other way around. So, I don't know. It's just it's topical. It's food for thought.
Oh, there's certainly lots to consider.
And I reckon we could sit around a beer and a pub and a pizza at night and all that, and you could talk about it until you're all black and blue in the face, couldn't we?
We could argue about this for years and still not come to a result.
Rob AU on the chat has basically given an example of that's what happened to Macromedia. They bought them. Adobe bought Macromedia.
A whole lot of stuff.
And Macromedia's, was it called? Yeah, it was called Dreamweaver.
Yeah.
Became Adobe Dreamweaver.
Mm. Yeah,
and
that's right.
They collected the whole stable of things. So,
yep, and also there was audio editing software too. Used to be around.
Oh, they had a. They've, cool they edit, still which, have that.
Yeah, and
Audition 3, I think, they're up to now, isn't it?
Audition, yeah, which is a very good product, yeah.
And if you look at what the competition to that is, it'd have to be, what's the Sony one that's out there? Anyway, I can't think of it. Lid uses it in the United States.
The competition for Audition?
Audio, yeah. I can't think of it off the top of my head. Anyway,
there's a Linux one that everyone uses too, which is horrible. What's the Linux one? I'm trying to remember the name.
Audacity is the one.
Audacity, I was thinking. Yeah.
It's around for PCs as well. Yeah.
Anyway. All right, you're listening to Tech Talk Radio. Boy, what a night it's been tonight. it's flown, and there's plenty more we'd like to talk about, which we're not going to get there. But back with Oddspot Gadget and Website of the Week after this.
You're listening to Tech Talk Radio, proudly sponsored by D-Link, building networks for people.
Suffering succotash, this has to be the best technology show on the internet, Tech Talk Radio.
Google been taken to court for forgery.
eBay was the truck and then Telstra pulled the license.
I need my fix of current Tech Talk Radio.
There's some suggestions they're all going to have SD card slots in them.
There's a new way of watching television that we're seeing emerge.
I can't give you that information over the phone.
Well, if you don't like it, then don't display the sidebar. When I had a merchant account with the Communist Bank, the material that was the what?
You're listening to Australia's most informative technology show, Tech Talk Radio.
Listening to Tech Talk Radio.
In this house, we obey the laws of thermodynamics.
Cool. This thing is amazing.
Tech
Talk Radio's Gadget of the Week.
This week's gadget is the Arcos 5 Internet Media Tablets. That's Arcos is A-R-C-H-O-S. The Arcos 5 is the flagship of a new range of portable media players, bringing the internet media and TV to a handheld device.
Do we need more?
I don't know. This one looks pretty swish. The Arcos 5 Internet Media Tablet lets you surf the web with an amazingly sharp and high-resolution 4.8-inch touch screen, enhanced by the ARM Cortex processor and Adobe Flash 9 video support. There's an email application. Your entire digital library can be stored on this little device, which features a high-capacity internal drive, anywhere from 60 gig to 250 gigabytes. Not bad.
Oh, that's not bad.
Yeah. You can also use it to control digital TV. There's a dock called the Arcos DVR Station. You can schedule TV recordings and all that sort of good stuff. Now, the asking price, anywhere from $625 down to $489, I found it online. So shop
on ShopBot or something?
Yeah, if you're interested. That's the gadget, Andrew, the Arcos 5 Internet Media Tablet.
Here it is, everybody, the world's greatest website.
Tech Talk Radio Website of the Week.
Everybody's ready to tap it out. Ready? Off you go, Dr. Ron.
New tab ready, Graham. Interceder.net, I-N-T-E-R-C-E-D-E-R. Interceder.net is a news aggregation search engine and a news video and photo search site. You can explore headlines from around Australia and also the UK and the US. There's three little flags at the top right corner there. And the website picks out keywords from news headlines and video and picture posts. Now, by default, it rates top news stories, technology news, entertainment news, and sports news, so you can easily see trending topics, and you can see how they comparatively weigh against one another. If you click on one of the progress bars, one of those topics, you can drill down into individual keywords, and there's a really good little intuitive timeline that's displayed and shows you how these topics have been trending, and where, and links to the source. So have a look. It's a good little aggregation site. I quite like it. That's our website entry.
Have you used it?
I have. I've started to use it more and more. So,
and what were you using? Give us an example of what you're actually using it for.
Just to see, just a snapshot in real time of what is trending. What's a trending topic on the web? So if you're familiar with the concept of trending topics, like on Twitter, for example, this is everything. This is what appears
right
on the World
Wide
Web.
That sounds pretty handy, actually.
It is. It's a good one. So have a look. That's our website, interceder.net.
There is a fine line between genius and madness.
Missed it by that much. I know nothing. Nothing.
Don't ask! For God's sakes, don't ask!
Houston, we have a problem.
The Odd Spot on Tech Talk Radio.
Britain's Defence Ministry says it will shred records of UFO sightings. After a huge rise in the number of reports submitted by the public, the Ministry of Defence said last week that new reports will be thrown out after 30 days. Rather than being kept on file.
So you're telling me that they're watching too many UFO things?
Well, the sinister... sinister part of this is that it means that details of the sightings will be exempt from Freedom of Information laws because...
Oh, what are we going to laugh at now?
Well, the records are going to be destroyed. Now, these FOI laws have allowed campaigners to force Britain's government to disclose details of apparent UFO encounters, but no longer. The ministry had 634 reports of UFO sightings last year, the highest total since 1978, when the public submitted 750. In December, Britain scrapped a phone line and an email account for the public to report details of UFO activity, saying that the service was a waste of defence resources.
Man, it would have been entertaining, though. Imagine getting those and playing them on the radio. Oh, that'd be great.
The headline was, UK's UFO unit will shred XX files.
Ah, very good.
There's our odd spot, Andrew.
Very good. That's another Tech Talk Radio for this week. More same time next week. Before we go this evening, very special thanks to Ruslan Kogan for speaking to Adam. That was good insight from his point of view. Thank you, Dr. Ron, for going out and grabbing that wonderful interview in
thank
the middle
you.
Of town and finding out all about that sort of stuff, which was really good.
And thanks to Warlock as well for joining us from Sydney.
He's just from Italy. That's right.
Sydney,
yeah. Now, one more thing just before we go. Congratulations to Kathleen Bigelow, Catherine Bigelow, who's the ex of James Cameron.
Yes, she pipped James Cameron, didn't she?
She took it out, The Hurt Locker. And if you haven't seen The Hurt Locker, go and have a look. It's an amazing film. And it's got a story, unlike Avatar, which is one. Avatar won for the right reasons. Technically, it was brilliant and it won a lot of those sort of things. So
I had a story. Avatar had a story?
Yeah. Maybe.
Oh, okay.
Maybe. Not as good as. Go and have a look at Hurt Locker. Just sweep the pool at the Oscars today. which was very good. All right, till same time next week, you've been listening to Tech Talk Radio. It's bye for now.
You've been listening to Tech Talk Radio, brought to you each and every week by a group of dedicated professionals from within the media, broadcasting, IT and telecommunications industries. The team consists of executive producer Andrew McComb, producer Dr. Ron, panellists Justin Dunlop, Graham Callaghan and Mark Diggins. Expert opinion from Adam Turner, and our US correspondent is Lydia Davis. Post-production facilities courtesy of Evolving Communications. Podcast production by Graham Callaghan. Tech Talk Radio is broadcast, recorded and streamed live to the world each and every Monday night at 8 p.m. from the studios of 3WBC. The crew wish to thank all the stations around Australia that take the show. Tech Talk Radio is available for syndication on your local station. For sponsorship and advertising, call 03 9818 2756 or visit our website techtalkradio.com.au for more information. This has been a production of Tech Talk Radio Vic and is subject to copyright and applicable laws and may not be rebroadcast without approval.